Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the former chair of the New York Film Critics Circle and National Society of Film Critics, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films are The Samurai and the Prisoner, The Rivals of Amziah King, and Rose of Nevada.
I have a Japanese movie to talk about this week. We used to get more of those on American screens than we do nowadays, but this is a good one. I have to say, I really do recommend it. A very fine movie. It was directed and written by Kiyoshi Kurosawa. This is not the same as Akira Kurosawa, who was one of the greatest filmmakers who ever lived and who made movies like Rashomon and The Seven Samurai and so forth. This is Kiyoshi Kurosawa. He usually makes horror movies. So now he's moved into a very different area. He's made a real old-fashioned kind of samurai movie, a movie about medieval Japan where a lot of the people are running around with great big swords and there's a certain amount of sword fighting and battling and so forth. It's that kind of movie. It's genuinely a samurai movie. It's a good one. It's also a long one. It's about 2.5 hours long, but I think it pretty well justifies its fairly long running time. So it takes place in the late 16th century, clearly in Japan. And we have a castle which has come under siege. There is a great big sort of uprising going on, and we have a guy named Araki Murashige, who is the lord of this area, of this castle and its surrounding territories. And again, they're under siege. And they're hoping that reinforcements are going to come, but they're not sure when or if those will ever get there. And they're waiting to see what will happen. And then somebody sends an envoy, a messenger, to talk to Murashige. And he turns out to be a person named Kanbei. So Murashige does not accept what Kanbei has to try to persuade him about. And in fact, what he does is he throws Kanbei into the dungeon in his palace, in his castle. Now, this is where things get really interesting, and this is still the very beginning of the movie. Kanbei really wants to be executed. He says, if you don't execute me, then people will think that I switched over to your side and I betrayed my own people. So execute me and send my head back to where I came from. But Murashige says, no, I'm not going to do that. You're going to stay in my dungeon. So Kanbei goes in the dungeon and he is very unhappy about that. And what the whole rest of the movie revolves around, although we only see it every once in a while, is the relationship between Murashige, who's the lord of this whole area, and his prisoner Kanbei. Now, there are a lot of other characters come in and a lot of other things happen along the way. But whenever Murashige gets into some sort of bind and isn't sure what to do and doesn't know what's supposed to be happening and how he's going to get out of some situation or he's going to conquer somebody or win in some situation, then he goes down to the dungeon and he talks to Kanbei and Kanbei gives him advice. So it's a very interesting relationship that they have. Now, one of the interesting things about the movie also is that Murashige is, he seems to be in a strange way, a sort of a, well, let's just say he's not as savage as a lot of people seem to expect him to be, and as apparently a lot of people in his situation back in the 16th century would have been. For one thing, he does not execute Kanbei. He has him thrown in the dungeon and goes on to talk to him from time to time. Another thing happens very early in the movie, which brings out this aspect of Murashige's personality, which is that there is a young boy who is also there. He was his prisoner, and everybody is expecting Murashige to kill the young boy, and he doesn't do that. He says there's no point in killing this young boy, regardless of who his father is and who his family is and all of that. So that's another thing. He seems to have this odd streak of mercy in him, which puzzles the people around him, and it kind of puzzles us in the audience too. Then one more thing about the movie, which, by the way, remember, is called The Samurai and the Prisoner, so it's very much about the relationship between those two. One more thing is that little mysteries show up over the course of the film, one after another, and they either get solved or they get kind of left a little bit mysterious. The first one that happens is when that young boy is killed. He seems to be killed by an invisible arrow. He was shot by an arrow, but there is no arrow there. He's just dead. and everybody is trying to figure that out. So little things like that pop up every now and again in the movie and help to keep things interesting and varied and keep the plot moving along. In a way, it's kind of cyclical. It's definitely a very episodic movie. It takes place in a lot of scenes. And in fact, the movie as a whole is divided into the four seasons. We have spring and fall and summer and winter. And again, we have different episodes, but they're all united together by the relationship between the Lord of the castle and his prisoner down in the dungeon. And it's united by other things as well. So it's a really interesting, long movie. I had a good time watching it. I think it's one of Kiyoshi Kurosawa's better movies, even though it's him moving outside of his usual horror genre. I found some of his recent films to be quite disappointing. This one's a very good one. So if you have any interest in the old samurai genre, then this is a movie for you. It's a good, solid, old-fashioned, and interesting and well-done and intelligent samurai movie. So now for something completely different, The Rivals of Amziah King. This is very much an American movie. It stars Matthew McConaughey, and it has a just a generally good cast. And I have to say, it's been getting extremely favorable reviews. I found it too scattered. That's the trouble with it. It's an interesting movie. It's certainly a very lively movie. It has tremendous energy. It has a fair amount of music in it because the main character, Amziah King, is, among other things, he plays bluegrass music with a group. So there's music in it, and there's mystery in it, and there's action in it, and there's violence in it. But the whole thing just struck me as being too scattered. I never really took to it. It's another long movie. It's over 2 hours long, and it did seem long to me, but mainly it seemed scattered, and it just didn't seem to all quite cohere together. That said, a lot of people are really loving it, so I'm kind of in a minority on this one. In any case, Matthew McConaughey plays the main character, Amziah King, and yes, he does have rivals. The title of the movie is The Rivals of Amziah King. And he seems like a very nice fellow. Again, he plays bluegrass music with this little group that he's in. And above all, he is a beekeeper. That's what he does. He keeps a whole lot of bees. And there's a whole lot of really interesting footage in this movie of bees and bees clustering and bees occasionally swarming. And there are some very interesting shots of bees all over the hands of Matthew McConaughey. I'm not sure if that's CGI or AI or whether he really did that. But in any case, it's some very striking shots of the bees and their relationships with humans. And we learn things on the soundtrack about how bees behave. Nothing particularly revealing, but all that part of it is interesting and is a big part of the movie. So the film gets underway when the cops come to Amziah King because a whole truckload of honey has been stolen. And they want to know if Amziah can shed any light on this. Well, he has no idea who might have done this, but it turns out that by analyzing the stolen honey, they get back some of it, and they have a barrel of it. By analyzing it, they can maybe figure out who it is who stole the honey. So this leads to the first big sort of comical, semi-comical complication of the movie. One of the people working with Amziah leans too closely into one of the honey machines and his hair is ripped off. So that kind of introduces one little subplot because Amziah brings him to the hospital and it turns out he has a heart condition, which later on plays a part in the story of the film. In any case, the whole thing gets underway with this investigation, although that's really only the beginning of the movie. Now, another very important character is his former daughter, foster daughter. Her name is Kateri, and she is played by a new actress named Angelina Looking Glass. Beautiful name. I don't think it's a particularly good performance, but she's a nice woman to look at and to listen to, and she's an appealing screen presence, let's say. So she comes back into Amziah's life, and so he, of course, introduces her to the bees. And she knows nothing about the bees. They had not been together for quite a long while. They've been apart. But she immediately takes to it. And so she accepts a position looking after his bees and his bee yards. And they do something together. They go to a school where a swarm of bees has settled. And they do something about that. And so she really becomes a part of his world. Now, about halfway through The Rivals of Amziah King, there's a huge plot twist, which I won't tell about. But let's just say it has a whole lot to do with who dominates the second half of the movie. The first half of the movie is really dominated by Amziah. The second half of the movie is really dominated by his daughter. And there's a whole lot of secondary characters played by good people, Scott Shepherd and various others. Kurt Russell shows up very late in the movie, the old Kurt Russell. He plays a guy who is not very nice. So again, it's a varied story. It has a lot of twists and turns. Various little incidents take place. It's another movie that's very episodic. It's all united. It's all one story from beginning to end, but it has sort of a lot of separate incidents that take place along the way. And again, there's that huge plot twist about halfway through, it took me by surprise. And if you don't know about it, it'll probably take other people by surprise too. But that said, I really did find the movie kind of scattered. I wish it clung together more. The acting is good, but nothing spectacular. And I have to say, I think The Rivals of Amaziah King is, as I often say, GNG. Good, not great. Finally, a movie which I think is very close to great, and this is my favorite of the three movies I'm talking about today, Rose of Nevada, written and directed by Mark Jenkin. He is a British filmmaker, and he is really good. This is the third movie he's made in a row that kind of deals with people living by or very near the sea. In this case, it's all about people who go fishing, take a boat on the sea and go fishing. Now, I gotta say right at the get-go that in more than one place, I have seen Rose of Nevada identified as a science fiction film. It is absolutely not a science fiction film. It is a fantasy. You might even call it a kind of a horror film, although it's not very violent. But it has no science in it, whatever, unless you consider people going out and throwing nets off a boat into the ocean, science. So it is not science fiction, but it is very much a fantasy. And above all, it is an absolutely gorgeous and almost staggeringly beautiful movie to watch. I just found it blew me away just as a real cinematic experience. Again, it was made by Mark Jenkin. He wrote it, he directed it, he did the cinematography, he edited it. It's all him. And so all of that gorgeousness gets credited to Mark Jenkin, a really good filmmaker. And now I think he has hit his stride and has maybe become a great filmmaker. So here's what it's about. We have a Cornish fishing village. That is a fishing town on the Cornish coast of England. And it has not been doing very well lately. And all the commerce in the place and all the money that comes in is people who take their boats out onto the ocean. And there's one boat that we follow in particular. And they can't even go out at the beginning of the movie because they're shorthanded and they need three people and they only have two people. And so that has to all get straightened out. We learn a little bit about the people who run this boat and their families. By the way, it's a very diverse movie racially. There's a black and white characters in it. And we learn about how the families operate and what the relationships are and so forth and so on. And we see the people go out on the boat. We learn a little bit about how they do their work and how they catch their fish. It's not a thing where you go out with a fishing pole. It's a thing where you go out with gigantic, huge nets and all of that. So eventually, something very strange happens. The boat comes back from a voyage, and our main character is very puzzled when he comes back to the town because everything is different from the way it was when he left on the boat for that particular voyage. Everything is different. The people are different. There's somebody there who committed suicide earlier in the movie. And he himself seems to be, well, there's a newspaper with a date from before he was even born. So something very strange is going on here, very mysterious, very fantastical. And that turns out to be really what this movie is about. But actually, the movie is much more about simply the relationships between the characters, how this character and other characters relate to these very puzzling things that have been happening. The movie seems to go back and forth in time a certain amount. So again, it's very much a fantasy. It could almost call it a horror movie because it's very scary sometimes, but it is absolutely not science fiction. But above all, and I got to stress this again, it is an astoundingly terrific movie to look at. It is very well acted by all concerned, but the cinematography of it, the look of it, the editing of it is just gorgeous. It's a movie that demands that you pay close attention. You got to put together the puzzle pieces yourself. And I'm not 100% sure all the ultimate puzzle pieces come together by the time the movie is over in ways that make perfect sense. I think the movie remains to some extent mysterious. That said, though, Above all, it is an absolutely stunning movie to look at. It has a really interesting story. It has really good characters, and they are very, very well acted. But above all, this is a work of cinema. This is filmmaking that is at a virtuoso level. And for that reason, I've got to celebrate Mark Jenkin. I think he's becoming one of the great filmmakers we have today, and I got to celebrate this movie. It has nothing to do with a person named Rose. It has nothing to do with Nevada in the United States. Rose of Nevada is the name of the ship, the boat that most of the movie centers on. But it is a very, very great movie, far and away one of the very best movies I've seen this year. So if you want a really wonderful, marvelous, gorgeous voyage, take The Rose of Nevada. So that is my somewhat seaborne story this week.
For which we thank you, as ever and always, David Sterrett, Films in Focus, the films The Samurai and the Prisoner, The Rivals of Amziah King, and Rose of Nevada.
Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera National Theater Live and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.